This is Maria Buyukos.
And this is Zachary Richard Hill.
And you're listening to Creative Honey. Hey guys, welcome back to Creative Honey. It's Maria and Zach here.
Hello again.
And today we actually have a special treat. We finally have another interview with the awesome Ben Hunter.
Yeah, we've been really excited to have Ben on for a while. And, you know, we were trying to kind of get our podcast up and running again before we brought on guests. And we felt like we'd done that. And we're really excited to bring on Ben. And Ben is a friend of mine that, you know, long story short, we worked together on a project called ProxArt, and I really got to see his career take off and evolve from photography to cinematography, and we get to talk about his journey a little bit and, you know, what he's been doing. But he's been doing some amazing things with Life and Time, KCET, PBS, among other things. If you go to his website, benhunter.co, you can see everything he's working on, and he's doing some really great stuff. So, yeah, without further ado, let's jump into, you know, our conversation we had with Ben and go from there. On today's episode, we have Ben Hunter on the show. Hello, Ben. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you guys?
We're doing good.
Yeah, no complaints here.
Yeah. So, Ben and I go way back. We've been friends for a long time. And we met together working on a blog and a magazine and a lot of different things through ProxArt. But, you know, we'll probably get into that a little bit later, but overall, do you want to kind of give us a little bit back about your, backstory and your history and, you know, everything that makes you you, basically?
Sure. Okay. I went to film school. That's kind of, I guess, where my story starts as far as what's relevant to this podcast. So I graduated, you know, maybe a decade ago, so it was a while. And I got into still photography.
Right.
And instead of making movies, I wanted to take pictures. So somehow I got wrapped up with this crew called ProxArt, and Zach was part of that. And we made a magazine for a couple years, quarterly. And had a lot of fun doing things in the suburbs, right?
Right.
eventually that just kind of led to us meeting other creative type people. And then I was able to get into video again, just because people needed it. And I had this, a tiny bit of skill on the back burner as far as video and filming things is concerned. So I slipped back into that. And
cool.
And then a mutual friend of ours, Antonio Diaz, wanted mm-hmm. to do... wanted to do a website that just involved food and storytelling around food. So he knew that video was an important part of having an online presence. Sorry, guys, I'm a little nervous.
Yeah, no, don't be.
And so he employed me to do that, oftentimes with just food as payment back in the early days, but we've
it's not a bad payment. I mean,
no, yeah. and I still expect food as part of
course
payment for most things I do. But so these days I do a lot of video work in the food space, for restaurants and chefs and things like that. I guess most recently or currently, we're doing an hour-long documentary with KCET, which is a local television station here in Los Angeles. They used to be part of PBS, and they broke off on their own. So we're doing an hour-long
cool
documentary with their support, and it's based on immigration and how immigrants have really shaped the food culture of Los Angeles. So it's been an incredible few months so far.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, that sounds super awesome. How did you even decide that you wanted to go to film school? Like, what was that moment where you kind of realized that's what you wanted to do?
You know, out of high school, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. When I was much younger, I had this thing in my head. I wanted to be an animator. I liked cartoons, and I was really excited about the possibilities of 3D animation. I think Toy Story was still really fresh. And so I was just like amazed by that. But then I think throughout my teenage years, that kind of faded away. But I've always really loved movies, and I loved watching movies and going to the theater. And I knew that I wanted to do something like that. So the community college that I lived near had several filmmaking type classes, and I started with an editing class, and I went there with one of my friends, and we just edited footage of things that either like already existing footage that they would provide, or if you had something you could go film it, or if you had filmed something. I remember I went to the Warped Tour one year, which is like a big music festival sort of thing,
right,
in Ventura County in California. And I had a video camera, and I just filmed the performances. So I took one of the songs and I cut footage to it. And I really enjoyed the process. And so that just kind of was the door that I went through into filmmaking. And I realized that there were schools that specialized for this. So I found the Los Angeles Film School somehow through like really archaic online searches back then. I just don't know how.
Yeah, I was doing similar
how
searches.
How far we've gone from then. But so I majored in editing at the Los Angeles Film School.
Cool.
But I also took all the cinematography classes because I enjoyed holding a camera as well.
Right.
While I was there, I realized I loved both equally, and but I also bought a digital SLR camera, and I was taking lots of photos, and like I kind of really enjoyed doing that as well. So, you know, I went down a different path by the time school was over, but that was my entry point into it. I've already forgotten your question though. So
yeah. So basically, yeah, no, I mean, we were asking you all about the, how you got into film school and what drew you there. But I'm also interested to kind of hear how you transitioned, you know, cause we, you know, I met you when you were a photographer and you're, you know, doing great work with that. But, I wanted to kind of know how you transitioned back from to cinematography. From photography, how did you make that transition back? I know you talked about that a little bit, but how was that process for you, you know?
Well, I guess I should just go through the path from, like, out of film school. I was really excited about still photography, and I immediately bought a 35mm SLR, and I took film development classes at the local community college. And I just kind of I dove into that for a couple of years, and just shooting a ton of film on 35mm, medium format, eventually large format, and just taking a lot of portraits and things like that. But I felt like I was still holding on to the visual aesthetic of cinema.
Right.
Those influences. So, I mean, I loved using like really long lenses, and I think I was really obsessed with like Tony Scott, the director of like Man on Fire and stuff like that. And,
right.
And he would use really long lenses, and I would shoot still photography that way, and I would crop it the way movies are cropped. So I kind of held on to that, and people would say, "Oh, your still photos look like stills from movies." And I would always love hearing that, because I think that's always just been what's in my head and what I want to put out into like the medium of photography, I guess. So, I don't know how things really transitioned, but I feel like, we just picked up small things. You know, I probably filmed stuff on iPhones before I was using, DSLRs, but,
right.
It just kind of faded into a thing where like I remembered, oh, I do love doing video, and just kept doing more of it, and people started paying me to do it, and I said, well, this is the way to go, right?
Yeah, sure.
That never hurts.
That helped. That will help dictate things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you know, it seems like a lot of people's career paths kind of just develop in this very natural way. Like, you know, you kind of set out to do one thing and then it just evolves. And it seems like there are just hints that you are going to end up doing a lot of cinematography, which is super cool. I'm kind of curious, when you get a new project, what's your process like? Like, how do you approach those scenarios?
Oh, well, as a cinematographer, obviously it's definitely a collaborative sort of thing. Like there's
right.
either, sometimes there's a director, sometimes there isn't, just depending on the size of the project, it might be just me working with, a client directly. And I guess I'm kind of acting as director as well as cinematographer,
right.
or there's a producer involved. But it's just communicating with the other people and figuring out what they want to see, what, you know, they'll oftentimes have found, me through previous work. And so I figure out what stood out to them, what resonates with them, and just kind of identify the visual style that I used in a certain, project that they enjoyed. Or sometimes it's just, sometimes it's even just music and things like that. And as an editor, I'm oftentimes editing most of the things I'm working on as well. So it's just talking and figuring out what they want to see. And then we're also obviously talking about the subject matter and figuring out what's appropriate for that. You know, deciding if things are handheld or if they're... locked down on tripods, or like are we using a lot of wide lenses, or is this like longer lenses, things like that. But I guess sometimes it's very complicated and everything's very planned out, and we'll storyboard things, and then other times it's things are last minute and we just have to run in there and just go with the flow. I feel like there's been a healthy dose of both of those sorts of styles.
Right. Yeah, I think it's just really important to hear about process and kind of how you approach it. And I think it's interesting how it can change project to project, because I know that's true for us.
Yeah.
And I think that's true for like any creative profession for sure. So I think it's good that you're kind of sharing some of that insight for... like, you know, like I said, it's for anybody, really. You know, I remember when we were working together, and you kind of brought this up a little bit, you know, like the specific tools and camera lenses and even cameras itself, I know has made like that's really important to you, from what I remember. As a photographer, is that still the same as a cinematographer? And I guess I have a sub question. I'm sure that kind of affects the way you kind of create your aesthetic, you know, when you're trying to compete in, like, you know, the iPhone, Instagram age. Can you kind of speak on that a little bit?
As far as, like, lens choice versus what's, like, a fixed lens on a phone, or...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just, I mean, basically, I guess what I'm getting at is that, you know, it's very easy, you know, with today's standards, I guess, just to shoot film, you know, and to shoot photography, you know. So how does, you know, the equipment or the tools that you use kind of affect that, your process, and how does it affect your aesthetic, I guess?
Okay. Well, I guess I mean, there's pros and cons. Like, if the simpler the tools and the smaller the tools, the less interruption, the less there is between me and whatever I'm shooting. So even though you might look at maybe like an SLR camera or even an iPhone or something, just something small like that, it allows the subject probably to be a bit more comfortable and less intimidated.
Right.
But obviously with fancier equipment and more tools and screens and lenses and things like that, there's more control. And so it kind of just depends on the vibe of the production, I guess. And so as far as like competing with like the ease of being able to shoot with an iPhone and everything like that, it's hard to say. I mean, I see things that are filmed on phones that just look spectacular. I mean, Apple even has a continuing ad campaign of shot on iPhone, and they won't tell you until the end of the commercial, and you'll see this and you're like, hey, that's really pretty. And then it says shot on iPhone. I'm like, oh, that's nice. And I don't feel like tricked. I'm like, hey, you know, I'm like, oh wow, good for them. And that's great. Like, I wish I could do that so well on my phone. I guess, again, I'm kind of trailing off of what
your
question was.
You're good. You're doing. Not at all.
If you want to rein me back in. But I mean, I really enjoy having a selection of lenses to fit, to solve a problem. And, for example, I guess, with the documentary that I've been working on with, Nathan Sage, the director,
he's a great guy.
He's phenomenally talented, and he's just one of the most genuinely friendly and kind people I know. So
every time I've talked to him, like, I always feel really good. Like, this, he's just, because he's so nice. I don't mean to sidetrack on, like, loving on Nathan Sage, but he's just a super nice guy. Yeah, he's really great.
Yeah. So
anyway,
it's been great working with him, and he, as the director, will be communicating to me saying what he wants to see, and it's great to be able to say, like, okay, we're gonna throw this lens on here and we'll see what it looks like. But sometimes it's just not working, and I'll maybe suggest like a wider lens, but just get closer, and he'll be surprised. He may have not considered that sort of solution, and the shot just looks so much better that way. So, you know, obviously there are benefits to having more tools at your disposal, but also I think the caveat or the downfall to having more tools is just being able to make decisions in a timely manner.
Yes.
I will obsess over over anything until someone tells me that we have to we have to make a decision sometimes, and I have to keep myself in check with that at times. So I think when you just have one or two lenses, sometimes it just works better for the production that way. Like, we're just going to use a semi-wide lens. So if you need to fill the frame with it, you just got to step in and just get closer to the subject. So, and I've done documentary projects where like 98% of it was shot with one lens. And I thoroughly enjoyed that process of being able to just the lens just kind of is obviously, it's like an extension of you, and you just start to learn how everything fits into that tool. So,
yeah.
What's that adage, like different men, different people will solve a problem in different ways, like a construction worker will use a sledgehammer, but a surgeon will use a scalpel or something. I'm totally butchering it.
Well, no, I think I know what you're getting at. I was actually going to bring it up where, you know, I think you're approaching the right way where it's a solution, like, based approach, and your process seems to be based on finding a solution. And I think it's a great point that you brought up earlier, because I know you talked about it just a little bit, but I completely agree in the sense where I think the best creatives out there are the ones that are looking to solve a problem rather than using all the fancy tools like in one project, you know, just because they know how to use it. And you see that obviously in the design world a lot. Like, oh, I know how to use all the tricks in Photoshop or Illustrator, but they don't know why to use it and when to use it. And I think you're kind of talking about that a little bit, you know. So, yeah, I totally agree with that, basically.
Yeah, basically having too many tools or just using different tools just for the sake of using them because they seem fun or neat,
right,
could be a hindrance in whatever project you're working on. And
For sure.
And I love Photoshop, just as an aside, just because Photoshop without like a classical training from a popular source, people just learn on their own.
That's so true, yeah.
And so everyone develops their own Photoshop language. And it's funny just because I know how to do certain things in Photoshop or, say, an editing program for video. And when I watch someone else use Photoshop, I'm like, why the heck are they doing it this way?
Like, there's someone, right.
But then they'll do something that just blows my mind, and I'm like, hey, can you show me how to do that? So I really love the way people find their own ways with common tools, and they can really surprise you. And that's fun to learn from other people that way.
That's a great perspective. I can't tell you how much I relate to you on that, especially with Photoshop, because I'm self-taught on that, and I always used to feel bad about it, like, because I had this weird perspective of it. But then I realized, like, what you've been saying, other people say, like, yeah, everyone's got their own way, and that's kind of the beauty of having a tool.
I kind of want to talk about the documentary a little bit more and go into a little bit more detail on that, because I think we talked about this a little bit on the phone, that it's coming up in a really important time, you know, because it's an election year, and, you know, it's, some people will think it's a more important election than usual because of who's running on either side. And I just think, you know, like, you're talking about how the food culture is affecting immigration. You know, how is immigration affecting the food culture in America? I think that kind of goes both ways. And can you kind of just dive into that and the documentary more in general?
Yeah, I'm not sure how. I think it would be easier for me to speak on how immigration is affecting food culture rather than the other way around. Obviously,
for sure,
food culture affects immigration in the sense that American societies, we've put food in an interesting place, on an interesting sort of pedestal. I mean, food is important to every culture, and we cherish it in different ways, but somehow food now, I'm sure this is the same everywhere, but I feel like we brag about food so much.
Right.
And the interesting types of foods that we can, I mean, it just all comes down to Instagram, really, doesn't it?
It's definitely changed the food culture. Yeah, seriously. I completely agree.
So I think that people are more excited about finding new foods and different foods, and so that makes it easier for people to be more entrepreneurs in the industry. they can set up a street stand making their food,
right,
and move their way into a truck and then a brick and mortar, and like there are a lot of success stories that way. And mm-hmm. I think that people coming from other countries can share the types of food that they make at home with a culture that may largely not be familiar, but very excited to try and enjoy. So I guess food culture affects immigration that way. But as far as immigration affecting food culture, Los Angeles is an amazing place to be, to have that conversation and to see those effects, just because we're so close to Mexico, and LA is famous for great Mexican food, and but we're also sitting at the edge of the country, and on the other side of the ocean is a ton of Asian cuisine.
I was about to say that.
So we have like well-established communities, like the Korean community in Los Angeles is, I mean, just K-Town is decades old, like, and strong and just like ingrained into LA physically. I guess culinarily speaking, is really breaking out, over the past decade or so with, I mean, Korean barbecue, but that's kind of just the tip of the iceberg for them. And I would encourage anyone listening to look beyond Korean barbecue. There's so much more. LA just has a lot of different people, and they're going to bring their food with them to retain this the culture that they had from home, and that's how they connect with each other and with their families. And what I've learned, I think, is that they are just they're so generous with the way they share their culture, and are just very excited that people can be curious about it. And so it's been an amazing experience, just being the recipient of so much generosity. I think there are a few places like LA that can have so many different cultures and so many different offerings as far as food is concerned. So,
yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think especially if you're in a coastal city, you know, east or west, but I think you're right. I think we're just in this very specific region where we're getting influenced by, you know, southern countries, you know, like Mexico, Argentina, et cetera. But we're also getting influenced by countries all over the Pacific Rim. So, yeah, I completely agree. It's a unique city when it comes to, you know, not just food, obviously, but just the culture in general. Yeah.
It seems like it's a nice, like, happy side effect of what you do is through your lens, you get to experience so many perspectives and you get to share that with the world. And I imagine it changes you so much every time.
Yeah, I think... Some projects are heavier than others. This one has been very different, just because we're talking with so many people and there are so many so many emotional stories, and we're just teasing apart all this information from, I mean, I think 25 different interviews of different people from Hispanic cultures, Filipino, Korean, even Middle Eastern, like Iran and Syria. So we're just hearing a lot of different stories and a lot of different experiences about coming to the United States and the inherent difficulties there are with that. So there are days where I've gone home and just kind of looked at my life and I'm like, man, I don't deserve to live the way I do. And it's created a lot of perspective for me personally. So,
sure.
I don't know. Just kind of reorganizes my brain every once in a while. This has been the heaviest project. I mean, not to say that other people don't have problems, but it's just such a different thing. So I think that obviously to get to the point that you were mentioning about, like, politically, it's an interesting time, obviously, because the fire being stoked only recently by the events in Orlando, people are just looking at what immigration means for our country, and unfortunately, a lot of people are looking at it through a really distorted lens, and it's and there's a lot of noise coming from that. So hopefully we will be able to make something that helps people realize that we're not so different from people outside of America, and they're the good outrageously outweighs the bad that happens and hits the 24-hour news cycle, and it gets obsessed. Like, the news networks are obsessing over how good like Filipino Sinigang is, or like Chabol or something like that, because that doesn't get viewers. But like it's such spectacular things coming from immigration are due to immigration, and people just forget that this is a country of immigrants. I mean,
we're all immigrants, basically. Yeah,
exactly. So, hopefully we connect to people in a way that just helps them empathize with what immigrants go through coming to this country, but it also just encourages them to step outside their comfort zone as far as the food they
perspective
eat. Yeah, exactly. And just the way they interact with people that don't look like them or don't sound like them. So I don't know. It's a lot of pressure, though.
It's so interesting just to hear how impacted you are by this particular experience. I know as a creative, there's just like a mixed bag of experiences with every project you take on. I'm kind of wondering, like, what's one of the weirdest projects that you've experienced during your time?
The antithesis of the documentary that I'm working on right now would have to be, I wasn't even a cinematographer for this project. I was an assistant cameraman, but it was a music video that was shot in the Bahamas for like a 13-year-old kid. So she just had rich parents and she kind of enjoyed singing, and
that's all it takes usually.
Yeah, I guess so. So I got flown out to the Bahamas, and we had the location scout who did work for the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Oh my gosh.
Cool.
Taking us to all those tiny little islands, like the sandbars where it's just a patch of sand in the middle of the ocean, and filming, and we were just drinking a lot and just filming and just swimming with wild pigs that that the population was overgrown on one of these tiny islands that someone just abandoned, and so they like out to the boats to beg for food, which is really sad. But I mean, that was a really weird experience, just because it's half work and then the other half like partying with these really rich people.
Right, right.
Yeah. As far as like really weird projects, that was probably the weirdest.
Cool.
That does sound pretty weird. It sounds like a little bit like a Rebecca Black type.
It totally like was.
Thing. Yeah.
Except just not internet famous like that one was.
Right.
Cool.
Hey, at least they tried though, you know.
Something we talked about, kind of preparing for this interview, and I kind of want to talk to you about here was kind of. You know, being like immersed in your craft, you know, for the long game, for the long term situation. Like, you know, we talked about retirement is not necessarily in, you know, maybe the game plan for us. It could be, but that's not something we're really thinking about when we do this kind of work. And I just wanted to hear your kind of thoughts on that again and how you feel about your craft and being in a creative profession in general and kind of what that means. Because I think a lot of people would be interested in that and interested in your take on that.
Well, I think choosing creative fields as a profession is more often than not a choice that is not because of money. I mean, we have hopes of, you know, getting to a place where we are living very comfortably and are able to spend money on just things that don't need to be purchased ever. But I think most people understand that most of life is going to be working toward that, but that's not why most people choose that life. They choose that life because they can't do the other stuff. And this is what fulfills us. And somehow we've got this talent doing whatever it is we do, and people give us money to do it. So we just go that way because it makes us happier. So when I think about, when I hear other friends talking about the retirement funds and things like that, and I think like I'm never really going to, I just can't really plan on having so much expendable income that I can retire, but I'm not quite sure I want to retire anyway.
That's the point I was trying to get at. Yeah,
because I don't want to I don't want to stop doing this. Even when I'm not getting paid, I'm still doing this because it, you know, it fulfills me. I just enjoy working with other people in creative endeavors, and you know, I guess it just kind of comes down to wanting to get the stuff that's in your head out to other people the way you know how, and you're going to do that whether or not someone's asking you to or paying you to. So
right.
That's a beautiful thing, you know. That's a just such a real. It's a really cool part of you know, finding your passion and continuing to chase it. You know, it feels like a blessing to be able to pursue that.
Right. Well, yeah. I think for me anyway, there was a really conscious decision to kind of really pursue and immerse myself in the trade that I've decided to take on. You know, and I kind of see it as a trade. You know, where. Kind of like, I guess what I'm trying to get at is like, I have the same feeling where I know that I don't want to retire even if I have the opportunity to, because I just, you know, I'm always seeking total immersion in the sense where, yeah, I just like, I always want to get better. I always want to learn something new about what I do, and I just want to keep doing it, you know. So I'm assuming it's kind of similar for you. Like, you're always trying to learn something new, learn a new like technique or part of what you know, like a new skill, or you're picking up new information and trying to get better as well, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, you and I had a phone conversation a few days ago where like for the first 15 minutes I just explained something that was in my head that I haven't seen anyone do yet, the way that I want it done.
Right.
And now I'm just obsessing over how to accomplish that. And, like, I hate being cryptic about it, but it is one of those things where, like, there's a competitive nature to it.
Sure.
But I think the true drive is just the enjoyment of that process and just being able to share something with people that that to them is novel, that makes them think about something or just say wow or gets them to smile or something like that. Those are like really basic, maybe cliche sounding things, but usually I'm doing stuff to impress people or just to just to satisfy that weird desire to get what's in my head out into the world. But I just don't imagine a point where I'm like, ugh, finally I'm 65 or whatever, I can stop doing this stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, why am I doing it now then? That's the whole point. Like, you look at musicians, people never stop, and they're
right.
Unless they're physically stopped. I mean, obviously, the musicians that we are familiar with that are very old right now are very successful, but
right.
They could retire. They could quit, but most of them don't. They just keep going. There's got to be a reason for that. So,
it's a beautiful thing when you just want to do it forever. And, like, you know, it's not easy to, you know, find that thing. But when you do, I mean, sometimes you kind of just fall into it from an early age. But sometimes you find it later in life, and then you just feel so much more fulfilled. It's like it's feeding your soul. It's not just like a vocation, you know, as a means to an end.
And I'm excited about that idea, Maria, about finding something later in life, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
But finding passion in different outlets, I think, is something that I really hope will continue to happen for me. I mean, right now I'm holding cameras and I'm clicking in an edit bay, and I really enjoy that. But I'm also exploring stuff involving audio and podcasts, and I'm a huge podcast evangelistic type person.
And that's why we have you on the show.
I obsess over this stuff, and I can't help but recommend a podcast to most people in every conversation.
I was gonna ask you that. Can you recommend some podcasts right now?
I mean, tell me your woes. I want to know what you need, and I'll give you a recommendation. I mean,
well, for me, like, this is probably, I'm really obsessed with what I do, and it's good in some ways, but also really bad. And here's one of those things where it's bad, because, like, I pretty much, for the most part, just listen to creative related podcasts, like Creative Mornings podcasts. I've even talked about on our show, the Creative Pep Talk podcast by Andy Miller. There's Debbie Millman's podcast, you know, Design Thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, those are the ones I really listen to. But I need to get out there more. I did listen a little bit of Serial and Startup, mm-hmm. and I really like those as well. But it's usually most of the time creative related. What about you, Maria?
Well, I do have mostly creative podcasts that I listen to, but I have like a guilty pleasure category. And I actually love mythology and folklore and kind of like scary stories. So I actually listen to a number of those. Like one of them is called Astonishing Legends, and another one's called Lore. It's just really interesting to hear all that perspective, like the kind of dark side of civilization and like things that could be true, but they could also be like slightly exaggerated. So yeah, I mean, I'm really open to pretty much anything.
I'm going to have to follow up with you later on those, because I would love to check those ones out.
Awesome.
Those sound good.
Okay, there's a podcast that I'm just absolutely obsessed with, and I recommend to most people because it's just kind of a universally amazing show, and it's called Love and Radio.
Mm.
Like love... And then the plus sign radio.
Okay.
And so they just have interesting characters, and they essentially the interview is put out to you in a way where you don't hear the person asking questions. It's less of a conversation back and forth, and it's more about just the subject narrating their story to you. And the way that the producers edit the show is it's like almost nothing I'm hearing elsewhere. It's yeah. got a very dreamy quality to it, and there's Ooh, great sound design.
That's cool.
And every episode is different, because they just find fascinating people, and they just peel that onion away. And
nice.
You know, you'll hear about someone who watched someone from their window into another window across the way, and just see this life being lived, and someone going through this transition, and then you'll hear about a guy who owns a strip club, and then you'll talk to a guy who was on a number of drugs, but also a very successful journalist, and just all these different wow. stories. And it's just, I love it, because
yeah, Maria has her excited face
yep,
on.
Definitely, I've talked to you about that. Yeah.
The back catalog is great, and you can't go wrong. I mean, there's quite a few interesting characters. Even there's one on a girl who does balloon popping porn. And it's exactly oh, what it sounds like.
Nice.
And, like it's really it's funny. Weird, but like you have to listen to that stuff, because like these are people that these are like real people, and I can't help but
right.
listen to every one of these stories, because it's just fascinating to me.
That is so up my alley. Like seriously.
And
thank you for bringing that up.
In full disclosure, I'm actually. Working with them on potentially producing an episode for them.
That'd be so cool, man.
I think it's quite awesome. Set in stone right now, but I met with the subject that I would want to do the episode on. I met with him this past week, and so, you know, things are moving forward, but
cool.
I feel like I should just say that but I've been a huge fan
Super
of
awesome.
the podcast for a couple of years now, so
yeah you kind of got me into it back in the day.
Oh, and no, you know, I can't take credit for that, honestly. You know who we need to give credit to is Justin Miyamoto.
Oh, that's so true. Oh yeah.
Who showed me Radiolab, and really yeah. he showed me that radio can be something astoundingly creative, and not just a source of information, but just the way they tell their stories and the way they weave people's voices together, and sound design and music. It's just like none other. I mean, Radiolab's spectacular. Right. And
I remember I got my start with Radiolab by Justin, of course. And Justin's like, mm-hmm. yeah, he is the godfather of making us listen to podcasts and us enjoying it. You're
another,
right.
Another really good one is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Oh,
I mentioned
yeah.
that to you guys, and you said you'd listen to a couple episodes. It's just kind of a variety show, and you hear from all different people that are well-known, people are not so well-known, but it's got a little bit of politics sometimes. It's got sometimes a movie star or... One I really love that they have recurring is a guy who's been interviewing people throughout the political campaigns, and he takes the transcript of their interview, and he turns it into a song. And
oh, cool.
He reads it. He basically sings it back verbatim to like a piano track, and I really enjoy that. And
That sounds pretty fun.
That is pretty cool.
New Yorker, yeah. New Yorker Radio Hour. I mean, there's some really obvious ones like This American Life and
right.
Oh yeah,
and obviously Radio Lab. I'm also really enjoying the political podcasts that help me.
Sure.
I don't have cable, and sometimes I read news, but I do a lot of driving, so I like to get the current news. While I'm driving, and so I listen to the Slate Political Gab Fest and NPR's political shows are pretty entertaining.
Oh, right, yeah, definitely.
Slate has one called Trump Cast, which
that's awesome.
Oh, that must be interesting.
You can imagine it's very entertaining. They usually have
I can imagine.
Yeah, I think like 2 episodes a week, so it's and they have this guy who sounds a lot like Trump, and he reads its tweets every week, and it's very
cool.
Oh man.
Anyway, I could go on and on. I'm sure I've gone on too long about podcasts.
No, not at all.
And we love hearing your perspective, and it's been a really cool conversation. You have so much insight, and we're interested in anything you're doing because you sound like you're doing some really cool projects. We love your work. It's beautiful. It's phenomenal. And it's been awesome chatting with you.
Yeah, we'd love to keep talking all day, but we didn't want to take too much of your time. So we just had a couple of closing questions as we kind of wrap up here. The first one being, kind of that general advice that you could give question. Like, we have aspiring photographers and filmmakers listening to the show, and what would you like to tell them? You know, like, what advice can you give those people looking to get into this industry?
One of my favorite pieces of advice that I've given is to, like, when people are just starting out and they're trying to develop their own creative skills, is I tell people to just copy the people that they're most fond of. Just try to make a carbon copy of the things that you admire, and you're never going to be able to do that 100% successfully, and you're going to have to find your own way to get close to that, and you'll figure out when you try to do something exactly like someone else what you like and what you don't like and what you think should be changed, what's better. And we learn a lot through problem solving, and that was kind of the way I think I still work. And I don't know. That's the advice that I typically give people.
That's good advice. That's actually similar advice to what Zach gives about, like, graphic related stuff.
Well, it's just, I think it's okay to kind of draw from the past and really admire the people that got you into this passion or this craft in the first place. And I totally agree. And then, go from there. Because, if you keep doing the work, you're going to find your own voice for sure. I completely agree. Mm-hmm.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Great advice. And where can our audience find you online?
Well, I have a website, mm-hmm. benhunter.co. Not com.co, unfortunately. .com is being held ransom for thousands of dollars.
Oh man.
Other than that, sometimes my stuff shows up on lifeandtime.com. That's time with a THYME. In the fall, you'll see some stuff on KCET. Online.
That's awesome.
And I think it's channel 27 or something like that. Anyway, you can look that up. But
that's legit.
Great. Yeah, we'll post your website and your new reel. We want to share your new reel with our listeners. That looks great. We'll have that in our show notes. And it's been really great talking to you, man. I know we've been friends for a long time, but I told Maria when we started doing this podcast that we have to get Ben early and hopefully often on the show, because I think you bring a lot to the table, not just as a creative, but just as a, like, an intelligent person in general.
Exactly.
So we really appreciate it.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Guys, thank you so much. And hopefully I'll be less bumbly and rambly next time.
If you are, that's good. Cause we have a lot of cool things to talk about.
You're like, okay, I really I need to stop talking, but I can't find an exit out of
this wrangle.
But it's good, though, just to kind of let it go naturally, like a natural flow, natural, you know, element to when you're speaking about your experiences, you know?
Right.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you guys. I mean, I think conversations like these are always therapeutic. So I really appreciate what you guys are doing and being able to, you know, make those conversations happen with all different types of people. So thank you.
Well, we appreciate that. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, we're really excited to bring more of that element into our podcast, you know, and get different perspectives, because people are such a wealth of knowledge, and it's just so cool to see through other people's eyes.
Yeah, for sure.
You know?
keep doing it. You guys are doing a good job.
Thanks,
thank
man.
You so
yeah,
much.
Appreciate it, dude. Have a good one.
Yeah, you. Thank you.
That was a really, really great time we had with Ben. It was a really fun interview, and we got to talk about a lot of really important things about creativity and the process. And, you know, it's always great to hear. I know I listen to podcasts because of, you know, like, you know, one reason why I listen to them, I should say, is that they hear about the backstories of artists and creators. And so it's always really nice to hear, you know, a story that Ben had, you know, about what he's been doing and how he got there and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, no, this was a really great opportunity. We loved hearing all the awesome things he had to say. And this is why we want to keep bringing on more guests to Creative Honey, because there are so many perspectives that we can, you know, record, and you can listen to it, and we can all kind of just get a better idea of what's going on around us in the creative world.
Yeah, definitely. And I know this was a longer podcast for us than usual, so we want to just kind of wrap it up here really quick and just again remind you where you can find Ben, benhunter.co. And you could find us now on Instagram. Maria, what's our creative handle?
Our creative handle is actually at Creative Honey, no
or
space.
Instagram handle, I should say.
Yeah, it's just at Creative Honey altogether.
Cool. And then, you can find us individually on social media as well. So that's it, guys. Thanks for listening. And we got some more guests lined up. And keep fighting the creative fight.
All right, we'll talk to you guys next time.
See ya.